Hi everyone, this is Chris DC and welcome 3 years on since my very first Nostalgia Interviews podcast. And my guest this week, it was so good to catch up with Paul Hedges. Paul and I went to university together. We learned that for Paul, Lampeter was not his first choice, but he's glad that he went there to do his degree in religious studies and theology. Who he is as an academic and as a person, he can owe to the time that he spent in Lampeter. We also learned that he once got inspiration for an essay from a strong bottle of cider. Perhaps we should move on at this point. We talk about how computers didn't exist at the time that he was an undergraduate, certainly not for the purposes of writing essays. These were the days when people would pay others to type their dissertations up for them, and when the library had a card catalogue. He recalls the chance to explore the Lampeter countryside. He talks about his lower middle class upbringing, playing Dungeons and Dragons in the days when it wasn't cool to be nerdy. He talks about growing up in one of the most boring towns on the planet, his words. Paul had friends who represented very different worldviews to his own. And today, Paul, who is a professor in Singapore, is interested in interreligious relations and how different worldviews or traditions make sense of each other. He talks about how people understand each other, the importance of auto-ethnobiography. You cannot understand people without understanding their location. We talk about how different research is now that we have access to technology, but Paul reflects on why there is something missing. Perhaps there's less time these days for cogitating. We talk about post-colonialism and the move away from the Western paradigm. Paul talks about why he has positive memories of childhood and why, thanks to those Lampeter discos, he can't get YMCA out of his head. He talks about the way that we airbrush the negative stuff. We learn why his younger self would be amazed to see what he is doing now. And at the end of the interview, we learn why Paul wishes, perhaps, that he had travelled more. It was so good to catch up for my latest Nostalgia interview with Paul Hedges. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Paul Hedges, or should I say Professor Paul Hedges, from Singapore for my latest Nostalgia interview. And of course, Paul, we've known each other for decades.
Yes, about 3 decades, which is a good time on this earth.
Yeah, because the background that I've got behind me is, of course, from Lampeter, where we met. Well, I think we must have met pretty early on in the 1990s.
Yep, I mean, it must have been, because I arrived, of course, I knew your sister before I knew you, because she was my direct contemporary. We both arrived in 1988. And so, yes, whenever you arrived, as I knew your sister, there must have been some connection, introduction there along the way.
I've got some recollection one time. It must have been about 92. I think it was before. I think maybe, you'd graduated by then and you'd come back to visit. And of course, it was Conti's coffee shop. And I seem to recall Susan introducing me to you. And then 3 years later, of course, we ended up living in the same house, didn't we? House of postgraduates.
Beechwood, yes.
Yeah, on the high street. So we got to, and of course, we were certainly contemporaries. Not rivals, of course, but we also were doing PhDs at exactly the same time. And as I recall, we had our PhD vivas a week apart. I think you had yours like the Friday before mine. Do you remember that?
Some of that actually goes off in a bit of a blur somehow. I think maybe I prefer not to remember the actual viva itself. But yes, it was very close together.
Yeah,
because I took a much longer going through my master's and then a year out sort of in between. So yes, so you caught up.
I did in many ways. Yes, I blossomed in Lampeter, and yeah, we did PhDs in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies. And but how did the journey begin for you? Because obviously you went there in 1988, and am I right in thinking that you did your degree in Religious Studies?
Religious Studies and Theology joint honours. I ended up at Lampeter. It wasn't one of my choices initially. I'd actually wanted to go to Newcastle to study religious studies and psychology, which I think back then is the only place in the country you could do those two things together. But my A-levels were mismarked, at least that is my claim. I know that's partially right, because I did actually go for a remark, but it basically takes about 6 months for them to come through. So I ended up at Lampeter, like many people, through clearing. So, yes, but I mean, it is a very fortuitous kind of sort of thing, I think I was sort of much happier being at Lampitt. And of course, I mean, that, well, decade or so I spent there, of course, you know, the department sort of flowered from being, if you like, a very good department into perhaps the best department in the country during that time. So, yeah, I mean, I was absolutely delighted that all of that worked out so well.
It's funny, isn't it, how those almost like serendipitous moments happen. And because it's easy sometimes to look back and think, oh, it's all predetermined. It's all there for a reason. It's all fate or whatever. But actually it's what you make of it. And I think you're right that there was something quite almost magical about Lampeter because of it. It took so long to get there that once you were there, you were kind of like stuck. And some people probably thought, oh God, this is like a prison. I don't want to, you know, I made a big mistake. Because others, and obviously it applies to both of us, saw it as an opportunity, and it was a small place. We all knew each other, and also it kind of meant as well that there was a really good, vibrant sense of community. And of course, we were both in that luxurious position of having got good first degrees and then staying on for subsequent. Well, both our cases, of course, we did our masters and then our PhD in the same place. So it's a place that's really, I think, over the years, very much a foundation stone for the academic careers that we ended up both pursuing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should also make a call out, I think, to my old religious studies teacher at school, Mr. Woof, David Woof, who basically recommended Lampeter to me after my sort of A-level results were not quite where they should be, as I see it. So, yeah, I mean, actually, because I spoke to the Lampeter people in Clearwin, and I said to them, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. And he said, what on earth did you do that for? So he phoned up Lampeter again for me, and he spoke personally sort of to them and said, you know, this person will be a bit confused, please let him in still. So, yeah, I mean, whether that's sort of the serendipitous or just, you know, the good people you meet along the way who push you in certain directions. And as you say, yeah, I mean, I came in 1988. I eventually left in 2000 with a few breaks sort of along the way within that. So, yes, I mean, sort of almost 12 years of my life there. So, yeah, I mean, you know, who I am as a academic and a lot of stuff is who I am as a person, if you like, was developed over that time. So surviving when you're 18, I mean, yet you're fresh out of school, you're still not sort of fully formed, if you like, perhaps as your adult self. And so, yes, I don't know if it was a maturing process because Lampeter allows you to sort of, you know, play around an awful lot. But certainly it was a huge learning experience in every dimension of my life.
Yeah. And I think what's also really interesting is that you go to a place, as you say, at the age of 18. And it felt to me as though that's when the reset button was pressed, because school was all well and good. But in school, it was a very competitive environment. I mean, I went to a very good school. I only realized that afterwards, because when I was at Lampeter, I was talking to people who'd say things like that they were the only people or one of the only people in their sixth form, if they even had a sixth form, that, you know, went to university. And in my case, most people did go on, and a lot of people went on to Oxford or Cambridge, and it just felt like the sort of, there was a lot of pressure, a lot of peer pressure, and I went to Lampeter, and it kind of felt that I went there on my own terms, and suddenly I was able to almost recalibrate, press that button, and learn and enjoy going to the library. And rather than being spoon-fed, I thought, you know, I don't understand this question, so I'll go to the library, I'll get some books out, and by the end of the week I'll know a few of the answers, and I'll submit an essay, and sort of that went on for 3 years, and suddenly I thought, actually, I could get used to this. And here I am now in my late 40s, and I'm still doing exactly the same thing. I'm writing books or articles, and I'm teaching my students and going to the library and you know, finding ways into the world that, you know, just seemed a mystery prior to the age of 18.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I think, again, I was lucky to be at a good school. I mean, it was a comprehensive school, but it sort of had a very good academic record. Again, most of us in sixth form would go off to university. I think I was in the worst ever year actually I had in my sixth form, in that I think it was only one person or actually nobody managed to go to Oxbridge, because they normally sent at least, you know, three or four more people off there. So, I mean, it's an exceptionally good comprehensive school. So, yeah, I'm very pleased with the comprehensive system that the country has. But as you say, arrived in university, it's completely different. I can't claim that, like you, I wasn't always the best student. I wasn't always sort of running off to the library like this new freedom out of school without being sort of pushed all the time. I mean, my undergraduate, I have to say, particularly parts of it, I probably missed more lectures than I would tell my students they should do. And I remember those kind of like all-nighters when you suddenly realise the essay is due in the next day and you go into the library at sort of 8 o'clock at night just before they close. And then just sitting up all night. I probably shouldn't tell the one story because I certainly wouldn't let my students know about it. It's the one time I went to the library and there were none of the recommended books available. So I basically sort of found the two most vaguely relevant books I could find, sat in my room for a bit with not much inspiration. Then I went to the spa and bought a great big sort of like litre bottle of very strong cider. And somehow after that, the essay just flowed. By 5 o'clock the next morning, I could hand this thing in. It was my lowest ever mark. It was 40%, a pass. And this was my first year, so it was okay. It didn't count towards anything. But yes, don't let any of my students hear that bit.
In those days, of course, all essays would have been handwritten. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing I actually printed it would have been on my master's, and I think my master's dissertation. And I, even my bachelor's dissertation, we handwrote them. And then there was one of the secretaries, I think she was in the English department. I basically took her my manuscript, then she typed the whole thing up for me. And then basically I went through to sort of check the spelling mistakes and sort of went round again. So, yeah, I mean, personal computers didn't exist back then. And yeah, I mean, somebody had to teach me how to like use one of these new desktop things in the computer center for my, yeah, for my master's dissertation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah, and Beryl comes to mind. I don't know if that was the same person, but we did have a secretary who worked in both theology and English, and she, I remember, printed out my undergraduate dissertation. And you're right, because I remember people who even got their PhDs, and they would submit their PhD like a week before the deadline to somebody that they would then pay to write the whole thing up. I mean, I find that shocking in a way, because of course I'm used to, and obviously it's the same with you, used to using a laptop or a computer. And of course, what you always do, as you certainly do with a PhD, even with an undergraduate essay, you would be reframing it and moving it around and taking bits out and constantly editing it and making sure the footnotes are paginated in a consistent way. The idea of giving somebody handwritten text and saying, here we are, can you print this out? And of course, you've got no chance to proofread it because it's, you know, the deadline's coming up. So really, the PhD as submitted is been put together by somebody who knows nothing about the subject area and didn't actually write the thing. So in a funny way, to look back, I find those extraordinary days. I think even my supervisor, Chris Arthur, said, I could be wrong on this, I don't want to malign him, but I'm sure he said that even in his case, his own PhD was done on a typewriter.
Yes, I said, I mean, there simply weren't personal computers or word processors then. And of course, yeah, lots of people, I mean, they couldn't type particularly. So yes, I mean, I think my one was done on a word processor type thing, by, as I said, to secretary. I don't think it's actually sort of on, it wasn't on an old-fashioned typewriter, I don't think. You know, some word processor type thing, and they printed it out. But yeah, I mean, that was part of the whole thing. And again, if you like, the whole library experience as well, because of course you went into the library and you didn't go onto the database, you're there to card catalogue. And of course all the younger listeners see it like, what on earth is a card catalogue? But you know, you'd go to the drawers and like, you know, the A's, you'd have to sort of search through to find like the author's sort of name under A or B or whatever it was, or subjects. And then you'd sort of find a sort of reference and you'd go off and find a book in the stack somewhere. And again, of course, most people today, you know, you simply go on online, they've got the online books. So it's a totally different world.
Yeah, but and of course the students now were, well, the students I'm teaching now were born after 2000, and so indeed after I got my PhD, so that they, you know, live in a completely different world where the internet obviously is been completely part of their infrastructure. But I remember it was 92, because I remember returning in the summer. Probably I have this recollection of Anthony Hopkins getting an honorary degree just a few months after he won an Oscar, so it was like a big deal. Yeah. And that summer, they automated, that was the word used, the library system. And I remember telling somebody, a friend in another university, that, you know, my university's library is being automated. And they looked at me like, you know, what now? So 92, they automated it. And you're right. And I remember a few friends of mine, or one particular mature student who was in our department, who really didn't like this at all. But she said, but I don't know how to use a computer. She said, I'm frightened I'll break it.
And I just thought it was just so funny because, you know, looking back now, that just seems, you know, really, I think the chances are you probably wouldn't break it unless you actually, you know, get a sledgehammer and actually sort of throw it on the floor, which maybe you would do if you didn't get the books that you needed. But it's a different world. And I think there's something very quaint about that. And it seems to sum up Lampeter really well, that although we might look back and think that, yes, things were done at a different sort of pace, it kind of adds to the mystique of the place.
Yeah, it does. And of course, I mean, it wasn't just, if you like, the university was perhaps slightly archaic in its ways. I mean, the whole town, to some extent, I mean, there's, you know, I wouldn't say it's, you know, still sort of, you know, sort of decades behind anywhere else. But because it's a slightly sort of more quiet place, it's not a big sort of city, you know, I mean, a lot of the shots, you know, kept it like their old world sort of charm. And I think this is part of the whole Lampeter experience, that, you know, you would go in somewhere that was in some sense, you know, like a little bubble that wasn't quite like the rest of the world as you had sort of known it before in various ways. I mean, having said that, my mother was sort of brought up in the countryside and would often sort of go up and visit sort of her relatives there, so I was used to sort of small sort of, you know, countryside villages. But this whole experience of living it and again visits in Wales, and it's so far from anywhere, is of course, you know, the train was taken out from Lambton in 1960. So again, you know, unless you're driving in, you know, every time you've got to train into sort of Carmarthen or Aberystwyth, and there's like an hour on the bus, you know, this sort of like a pilgrimage sort of almost, this extra sort of journey sort of out there into the back of beyonds. And, you know, when my friends came to visit me from Oxford University, it was like, what on earth has just happened? You know, the world is just not quite as I envisage it. I mean, what is this place that you've ended up in?
Yeah, and I think a lot of us, I mean, in my case, I was from Cardiff, made that journey westwards a lot of my school friends actually stayed put in Cardiff, it must be said, rather than eastwards. And it seemed to be like the opposite direction of flow. I mean, looking back now, I mean, I didn't obviously drive in those days. Obviously, I didn't have the sort of responsibilities that older age brings. But so in that sense, it was perfectly manageable, but I wouldn't want to do that now. I think that I've got the taste of a different kind of world, but Lampeter is very special and always will be. But I think there's all the difference in the world between acknowledging that and indeed going back, as I do for reunions, but actually imagining that would be a place that I'd actually probably feel comfortable in now. I suspect I wouldn't. I think I did outgrow it. I probably outgrew it sooner than I was able to acknowledge at the time. It was only after I left that I sort of kind of felt, you know, had a wonderful time there, but I needed to make my mark somewhere else. But particularly the undergraduate days, that for me feels particularly special. And I think also the friendships that I made then, you know, for many years, I didn't have an opportunity to meet up with people because Facebook was in its infancy, and I think you were one of the first people to contact me on social media. I wasn't when the last time I saw you in Winchester, I had a token Facebook account, and then suddenly in about 2017 I realized, not least because I was doing all this work on nostalgia, that I thought this is a great repository for finding people you know, with whom I'd fallen out, and you know, and I've never looked back. I guess it's similar with yourself.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't even like a natural social media user. I was actually forced onto it by one of my colleagues when I was at Winchester, Gina, who was there, who decided that like this would be a way that, you know, we would sort of connect with the students and have that going on. So I basically made an account to sort of, you know, for this interaction with the students and stuff in various ways. And then, yes, you start to make sort of one friend and another friend. And as you say, yeah, you know, I'm now in contact with people. I mean, I haven't physically seen lots of these people, you know, for 30 years or more, perhaps, in some cases. But, yeah, you know, we're friends on Facebook and we chat and sort of comment on each other's sort of pictures. So, I mean, despite some of the ills of sort of social media and Facebook, yeah, I mean, it has been an incredible sort of boon in that kind of way, in sort of, you know, making these sort of reconnections there. And also, again, you know, sort of bringing perhaps some connection to sort of Lampeter sort of back into my life. Because, I mean, I wouldn't want to say like you did, I've outgrown Lampeter. You know, it is an incredible sort of unique kind of sort of place. It's marvellous in its own right. But, yeah, I mean, you go through different sort of stages in your life. And I wouldn't say, you know, I've sort of grown out of Lampeter. I've simply, you know, had different experiences afterwards, I would say. And yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed the times I have been back there. And again, that's a really odd thing, because of course, I arrived, I said, 1988 as a student, and actually the first time I went back for years, I was an external examiner, sort of there for one of their sort of degree programs. And this was like sort of really odd to be sitting on the other side of the fence. And then I've been, you know, back for conferences and stuff, and I've, you know, delivered sort of lectures sort of there to the audience. And, you know, it's just, this is, you know, it's almost like a fulfillment, because I guess, you know, spent so long there like yourself. You know, it's not just like I was an undergraduate here and then you suddenly come back a long time. You know, it's just all the way up to your PhD. So there's kind of like this maturing sort of there. And now, you know, I always really love getting sort of back there and, you know, and seeing the place and what's going on. So, yeah, it's always been a fantastic experience for me, you know, every time I'm back there.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, of course, you were, although you had some experience of the country, you were from Maidenhead, weren't you?
Yes, Maidenhead, yeah, near Windsor. So, yeah, I mean, it's very much sort of commuter belt territory. I mean, London was sort of within an hour's sort of train drive that way, and I was sort of, you know, much familiar, if you like, with, you know, maybe, yeah, sort of London, sort of Reading, Oxford, sort of just above, sort of bigger kind of towns or cities. So yeah, I mean, actually, I said living in a place like this, and of course, I mean, your picture sort of exemplifies it sort of beautifully. You know, you're living in this house here, and literally 2 minutes away, walking, you're in the countryside.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I absolutely loved about Lampeter. You know, anytime, you know, sort of essays were getting too much, or work was getting too much, you just didn't want to sort of speak to anyone at the moment. You know, you could just go off on a walk and, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, you know, I was quite a big walker, you know, sometimes you just sort of go off and disappear for a whole day and come back.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just allowed that, you know, exploration of the surrounding countryside, which, you know, again, in those days, I didn't drive myself either back then. So, yeah, you were either on a bus somewhere or you were just walking out into the countryside.
Yeah, I think there's obviously a metaphor there. It's like the race, isn't it? Or the tortoise and the hare. And, you know, in a funny way, there are some people who were a lot faster at the age of 18. And certainly people I went to school with who did a lot better academically. But somehow I caught them up. And actually, I always remember watching a film. I probably watched it with you once. It was Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. And of course, I was still in my 20s then. And I always thought, no, the last thing I want to do is meet up with people from school, because they will always say, oh, what are you doing? And, you know, say, oh, I'm doing a PhD. And, you know, you've never left university. Therefore, I had this vision of people who were doing far better, earning more money than me, you know, whatever success is deemed to be. And at the time, I just kind of thought, no, I was still finding myself, finding my way forward. But it's funny, there came a point, and I think probably just in the last few years, when you realized that you were at an age where You're the same age as the teachers, in many cases, maybe older than the teachers, who seemed, in some cases, probably quite old at the time. I mean, my mum was younger when I went to university than I am now by about a year. So suddenly I'm in a different generation completely to as you say, being 18 and straight out of school. And so suddenly that has just made me think, well, you know, what's the competition anymore? You know, who are you comparing yourself against? Because you're comparing yourself against people you haven't seen in over 30 years. And lots of things happen in lives in that time that you shouldn't be beholden to that sort of paradigm of, you know, how many A-levels you've got or how many GCSEs you've got. And you know, for many years, even after school, I'd meet people in Cardiff sometimes, and we'd still be in that whole school mindset, and that seems a long time ago now. But in your case, what was it that, so when you were growing up, what kind of environment were you living in?
Oh, okay, that's a good question. Well, my father worked for the electricity industry, which of course back days this was sort of, it was still a nationalised sort of company, so he worked for sort of like the public sort of utilities board. I mean, my mother, I guess, got to say, sort of worked as a homemaker in these ways. I mean, she had worked in a bank when she was younger, but sort of gave that up when, you know, sort of children came along. And I mean, in many ways, it was a very ordinary kind of conventional sort of English sort of, and I'd probably have to say sort of lower middle class sort of background, you know. We had a car. I think during my childhood, we only had one holiday sort of outside the UK. We normally sort of holidayed within the UK. But, I mean, of course, living where we did in Maidenhead and sort of surround it is an incredibly sort of rich area. So lots of my friends at school, you know, I mean, their parents were obviously much better off than my parents. You know, not that we were poor in any sense and never sort of needed anything. But, you know, in that kind of sort of place, it was a, it was a different thing. But, I mean, to some extent, this never really occurred to me that much. I think my parents were more aware of it than I was, and kind of like it's now perhaps I'm grown up that some of this has sort of, you know, seeped in me when they, you know, sort of said, oh, you know, your types of friends or something. And, you know, but having said that, you know, most of my friends, I think they tend to be quite academic, you know, sort of fairly studious and sort of serious. And we probably were, you know, we played sort of Dungeons and Dragons and all these kind of sort of more geeky, nerdy kind of sort of stuff, which, of course, you know, was not cool back in the day. You know, sort of since Harry Potter has become sort of cool to be a bit of a nerd and stuff. But, you know, back then it was just totally not cool stuff. So we were the uncool kids on the block. And, yeah, it's just a very ordinary life. I mean, Maidenhead is one of, I hope I don't upset anyone, the most boring towns on the entire planet. I think, as it is very sort of ordinary sort of stockbroker place. There was a cinema in the town when I was young. I saw Star Wars there, the very first Star Wars when it came out. But sometime round about, I think I must have been about early teens, it closed down, so we didn't even have a cinema there anymore. So I had to go off to Reading or Slough or some of the sort of bigger places nearby. And it was also sort of reasonably sort of diverse. So I remember, you know, sort of I had sort of Sikh friends and sort of Muslim friends at school. And I mean, again, that's sort of part of my sort of trajectory into sort of going into sort of religious sort of studies, this sense that there are people in the world, because, you know, my parents were both, if you like, attending sort of Anglican. So I went to sort of Sunday school when I was younger and sort of regular sort of Sunday observance with them. So, you know, I kind of had this awareness from quite a young age, but, you know, not a serious awareness sort of back then. You know, there are people who see the world very differently from me. And one of my best friends from a very young age and still in contact with him, Steve James, I've basically, you know, is in some ways, you know, I've had a probably a longer continual contact in certain sense with anybody else, you know, was an atheist, and his family were quite distinctly sort of atheist. So there was this whole sort of, you know, set of different sort of worldviews going on there. So yeah, all of that, you know, was this, in this sort of blend and cocktail. And I said how much I was sort of concerned about this, I don't know, because, you know, reading sort of fantasy fiction sort of novels was my big sort of passion. Lots of Michael Moorcock, if people remember him, if they still read out, I'm not quite sure, but, you know, the whole sort of Elric and that kind of stuff, bits of Conan the Barbarian and Grey Mouse of Fitzlieber kind of sort of book. So lots of really trashy novels, often sort of perhaps more serious stuff was what I was reading in my formative years.
But it sounds as though the background that you had, though, really, because it's just funny of knowing now what you do, you with your work on interfaith studies and obviously a degree in theology and religious studies, you seem that all seemed to have perhaps molded you, because the research that you're doing now, maybe this is, you know, obviously I want to talk more about some of those sort of films and novels and growing up experiences, do you want to say just a little bit about what you are doing in your research? Because it sounds to me as though the seeds were very much laid back in the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, interreligious relations is sort of really my particular sort of passion. So basically sort of how different worldviews, different ideologies, different religious sort of groups make sense of each other. They understand the difference and diversity between them. So that's really always been my sort of guiding passion in most of my work. And yes, I mean, I said his first awareness sort of came... I was very young. It was actually at primary school. I first became aware of this difference because we had to hand in these forms for some reason. My parents sort of filled them out. And, you know, mine had sort of Christian on there, you know, because my parents took me to church every week. I just seemed everybody in the world was a Christian and everyone went to church on a Sunday. You know, it just, as you know, 5-year-old or 6-year-old self, you know, this is just the way things were. You know, and I said, you know, I saw sort of on somebody else's thing, like sort of Sikh, Muslim, sort of atheist. And it was just like, oh, there are people who do that thing, that little sort of box there, differently. And so, yeah, I mean, the seeds were there. And then, I mean, I guess sort of in the secondary school, we started doing religious education. Of course, in the UK, it's a compulsory subject. And it's one of the subjects I loved. You know, we had very good religious education teachers. And yeah, my first teacher, her name I can't remember, but she sort of first instilled the passion. And then I said sort of David Wolf, who took me over for sort of O levels and then into A levels in this. So yeah, I mean, this kind of sort of interest in difference was always there. And you know, again, because I had these sort of friends, this sense that there was something going on. And actually, maybe also through this, when I was getting confirmed, sort of within this, I was sort of confirmed in the Anglican sort of tradition. You know, I remember sort of asking my mother, you know, what's the position of the church on all these other sort of traditions? And she was like, well, I'm not really sure. Maybe you should go and ask the priest. And I didn't ask him because I kind of thought the answer he would give would not be one I could accept. Yeah. So I decided, okay, I can knock rock the boat and go through this confirmation stuff by not knowing that actually I probably don't agree with all the stuff you want me to think. So yes, this sense of sort of diversity and this interest in like this openness to other worldviews. Of course, I'm no longer quite where I was then. I've moved on in all sorts of ways. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's been with me from an incredibly early age.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I had a similar experience, and it showed that the fact that we both ended up in academia shows that actually it was some of the, maybe the feeling that these questions were not adequately being answered that prompted us to sort of find out the answers for ourselves, which we did through our our academic studies. Because I remember going to see my priest. Well, in those days, of course, women couldn't be ordained. But I remember we were doing something. I must have been about 14, and it was my RE teacher who set us an assignment on whether women should be ordained as priests. And we had a female deacon in the church, and she did most of the services. She obviously wasn't allowed to take communion, but she did, you know, 90% of everything. And I guess looking back, it was a very sore subject for her. But I remember asking her, thinking that she'd be really happy to talk about this topic because she was a woman, and she was, if not a priest, she was a deacon, and so she obviously would be somebody who would have a few thoughts on this issue. I thought she'd be happy to engage with me. Quite the opposite. She actually was really quite unhappy. I realized afterwards, of course, the reasons I asked her in the company of the vicar, and I guess maybe they had different views, maybe there was a difference of opinion there. Anyway, so I learned the lesson that there was me thinking that here was an obvious topic and it was a no-go area. So I think that kind of not quite traumatized me, but it did also make me a little bit less keen to sort of ask questions if I wasn't convinced I'd get the answer. And of course, at university, I was able to get all the answers and the books wouldn't answer me back and I wouldn't be told you can't read this. And my tutors didn't say you weren't allowed to read this book. I'd always take the line if the books were in the library, then they were there because they were, somebody deemed them, you know, to be worth, you know, helping our students with their studies. So in a funny way, you're right. And your career has been one in which you've addressed that question from multiple angles, because you do a lot of work. Am I right in thinking Hinduism is one particular area that you've engaged with?
Yes. I mean, well, my PhD sort of led into this. Actually, it's a bit of a story behind how I got to do my PhD. And I wanted to look at a chap called Bede Griffiths. He was a British sort of monk who'd gone out and lived in sort of an ashram, like in a traditional sort of Hindu sort of life there. And I was looking for a supervisor. And actually had been offered a place with Ursula King at Bristol to do this. But I tried lots of people and most people said no, simply. I mean, more traditional universities were like, oh, this is too multidisciplinary, what you want to do. So we can't possibly do multidisciplinary stuff. But Ursula King agreed to take me on. But she said, you've got to wait for a whole year because I've got too many students. I can't take you on until at least the following year. So I went back to Lampeter and I spoke to Paul Bratton, who had obviously taught us there, and again, talking about, you know, being open, you know, in many ways, I think we're incredibly lucky being at Lampeter, that if you like the staff there, you know, there was no closed questions. It was not, you know, also we were doing theology as part of it, it was not confessional in any sense. You know, everything was on the board. It wasn't like this is, these are the doctrines, which happens in some theology places. You know, this was just, it was basically religious studies about Christianity, as I understand it, is what we were doing. But I went back and spoke to Paul Badham, and he basically just said, oh, here's this whole pile of like sort of missionary sort of conference documents from the early 20th century. Nobody's ever done anything with these. Go off and read them. And I thought, oh, missionary theology, not really what I'm interested in. But, you know, I went off and I read them and sort of gave him first sort of draft. He said, yeah, okay, do your sort of PhD on this. And I thought, okay, you can take me up straight away. So that's good. So yeah, I stayed on at Lampeter for my PhD, which hadn't been my plan initially, because, you know, I thought it was good to sort of go and sort of learn elsewhere. So I ended up very much sort of Christian, sort of Hindu relationships in the 19th century. So like these early 20th century documents basically gave me questions as to what happened before this. How did we get here? And then back here. And so basically, you know, my PhD kind of worked backwards. It's like a detective investigation. Like, where did it start?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was sort of part of it. But I've done bits since then. I've actually got a very recent paper also looking at sort of Hindu-Christian things. It'll be out in June, I think. But yes, most of my stuff has looked at sort of Christian. I've actually done some Christian Confucian. I've got one paper on Christian Taoist. I've got an edited book on sort of Christian-Muslim relations. And this is probably shocking lots of sort of academics who think, oh, my God, you've got to specialise in one thing. But again, like my interest in, like, is really, like, you know, the dynamics behind this, sort of the theories, rather than like the traditions themselves. And if you like, you need to look sort of at different traditions to understand, I said, a lot of sort of these dynamics. If you just look at one thing, then you understand that one dynamic. But if you want to understand the theories, then I kind of think you need to look broader. I've ended up sort of as a very diffuse, I mean, centered around these kind of central questions of, you know, how do people understand each other? And in a very basic sense, that's kind of, you know, what I do. How do people understand each other? But yes, it's gone in different directions out from that.
It's funny how research develops, really, because I always took the line, and that this was my Lampeter education, and it's not a bad thing, but it'd always be, you know, not so much who were the people writing the books, but what were they saying? You're engaging with their arguments, you're engaging with their ideas, you're not really doing anything autobiographical. It's very much in the ground of ideas. And that's great, because you know what Kant or Marx or Durkheim or whoever it was, you know, what they represented and so on. It's only in later years that I started to probably think, not least because you'd start to meet the people and get to know them who were writing some of these books. And sometimes you'd think, you know, gosh, the person, I found it with Ninian Smart once. I met him at a conference, and he was a wonderful, almost like he'd give an academic paper like an after dinner speech. It was full of jokes. It was very off the cuff. He was very disarming and he was very funny. But I was sitting there fascinated because I thought, this is a man who's obviously like the pioneering figure in religious studies. And he's somebody who's, you know, broken the mold. And he's somebody who's a very erudite, known for being a very erudite figure. And yet here he is, offering almost the antithesis of an academic paper. And I guess because of his, at that point, he was obviously past retirement. So this would have been at a BASR conference in Lancaster in 96. So only about 4 years before he died. And at the time I thought, gosh, this is so interesting. And yet his paper was the one that stuck with me. Rather than the sort of papers that I gave, where, of course, everybody writes, you know, they've got half an hour. So you make sure that you pack it in thinking that you don't want to waste a single moment. But often they're not the best papers to give at conferences, even though you want to make sure that you're getting, you know, giving value for money. So it's interesting, isn't it, how your apprehension of the university sector and of research changes over the years. I mean, what would you say you find very different now compared to when you started out, even as an undergraduate, in terms of what you think research is all about?
Yeah, well, I mean, partly I echo just what you're saying, like this autobiographical thing. I've actually, again, don't want to talk about what I've written, but very recently I've written a paper basically on, if like a self-autobiography as academic work, which kind of like some of the history I've sort of mentioned, sort of my version, if like into religious sort of stuff, but it sort of looks at my own sort of personal sort of experiences and uses that sort of as data and says, hey, you know, why am I the kind of academic I am? Why did I think this then? Why do I think this now? So, I mean, guess autoethnobiography is the technical term for sort of that. But yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. You can't understand people without understanding their location. And this has been a huge change. I mean, partly, I mean, off my early stuff, it was quite sort of philosophical, because I did sort of my, part ones, philosophy, theology, religious studies. And I've always had this inclination to sort of philosophy. And I should say philosophy, it's always about, you know, the ideas. And these have seemed to like float apart from the people who say them. And, you know, increasingly as I've gone on, you can't, there's a context, you know, the time, the place, you know, the way they were feeling at that particular time, all of that is part of this. And I think sort of academia takes that much more seriously now. But yeah, I mean, also I think some questions around sort of the nature of sort of research itself. Actually, early this afternoon, I was helping my on with some of his history homework. He's currently doing his IB's International Baccalaureate, kind of equivalent to the A-level for people not familiar with these. And if you're American, I have no idea what the equivalent is, but pre-university stuff. And he was looking at the fact of primary sources for something. I said, you know, I've got no idea where you sort of find primary sources, you know, sort of the documents on this particular historical event. So I kind of sort of went online and sort of showed him some, found a few sort of things. And, you know, after I'd finished, you know, sort of, I don't know, sort of 20 minutes, I said, you know, back in the day, that would have been a month's research. Because, you know, a lot of it, you know, would have just been in some archive somewhere. You'd have had to, like, you know, get your travel girl aunt and go off to this place and sit looking through these boxes and sort of finding all of these papers there. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, research now is incredibly easy because everything is there. And again, during my sort of PhD, you know, I remember while, if you like, the university life was pretty well stocked, there were always articles or books you didn't have. So you'd submit your interlibrary loan form. Again, particularly because I said I was doing some stuff sort of around India, sometimes people would sort of go off, you know, and they'd be sent off to India somewhere, and I'd, you know, wait several months. And then several months back, you know, somebody in sort of, I don't know, St. Stephen's College in Delhi had sort of, like, you know, photocopied all of these, like, sort of 19th century sort of journal articles and sort of posted them sort of back to me. So it was a very, very different world to sort of, you know, getting into sort of research and sort of finding out information. And, you know, I guess it's kind of like into this nostalgia bit. I mean, in some ways, you know, it was a really sort of hard drawn. And of course, I mean, some stuff is still hidden in archives and you've got to actually get to the place to find this. But so much stuff is digitized now that it makes that easier and quicker in some ways, at least to do certain types of research. But, you know, I always think there's something sort of missing in this. Like when you can just sort of like go into sort of Professor Google and sort of type it in and then like you've got 100 articles and you just can more or less instantly click through to sort of most of them. You know, that whole process of like, you know, sort of discovery and the distillation of time changes. And actually, just before we started this, you were talking about sort of the REF, the research assessment exercise. And while we don't have the REF in Singapore, basically now I'm sort of get an annual sort of research review here. So every year I've got to sort of, you know, produce a certain amount of stuff. So, you know, there is this pressure on you to keep producing and producing and producing. So again, you know, sort of back in the day, because you did research differently, now you read one article and, you know, you've got sort of six articles, you know, and it's going to take some time to get to next few. So you sit them and you read them and you digest them sort of much more. Whereas now, you know, 20 articles already there sort of in your inbox and, you know, it's just, you have to get through so much quicker onto the next thing. So I think there's sort of less time for sort of that cogitating and, you know, people would spend, you know, 20 years sort of writing one book in back in the day. And, you know, I've just spent 6 years, you know, on one book, which, you know, I'm sure there's scholars, you know, this is not a productive use of your time. Why did you take so long on that book? But, you know, in a sense, you know, the book needed that long. Maybe it needed even, you know, very pleased. And, you know, it's much better for sort of being a 6 year book than a 2 or 3 year book. So yeah, that whole sense of time, and again, I said this production, because, you know, particularly like think of our sort of professors, incredibly, you know, productive scholars, you know, you might have 4 or 5 books in your career, 20 articles, and, you know, you were sort of a productive beast. These days, you know, that's debased to just about be acceptable in many places.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how that shift has happened, because something happened over the years where, and social media has contributed to it, but where there is so much data, so much information, that there's a point where you realize that you can't possibly engage with all of it, and that can actually lead to a form of paralysis, because, as you say, you want to do this project but you just don't have the time. Whereas once upon a time you'd go to a library, and even if the library didn't have all that many books, because you'd made that pilgrimage there and you couldn't go anywhere else that day, you'd make the most of the scant resources that were there, and you might actually then find some good nuggets, you know, stuff that you wouldn't necessarily think would be worth looking at if you'd had a wider range to choose from, but you'd focus on the scant resources that were there, and you felt that you were doing this painstaking work. These days, as you say, there's so much you can access, you have to have some sort of like filter at work. And then there's always that sense that it's never enough. I mean, I'm unconscious it, you know, even with these interviews that I'm doing, there are so many that I'm doing, there comes a point where, you know, you just, you know, cannot listen and re-listen to the same one over and over. And I edit them and then I have to move on to the next one. And I don't even get a chance anymore to listen back to the ones that I've recorded. And I think that one day, I think, you know, people will really cherish. I mean, I've always kept a personal diary, but it's just like having a record that almost like shows how somebody went from where they were then in the 80s, for example, when you didn't have social media, to today, and follow that thread through. Because as I say, generations now brought up on the internet, brought up using social media, somehow that it's either a luxury that they've got all this privilege and this opportunity, or it can be a curse because there is this information overload, and it doesn't necessarily follow that they're necessarily doing any better than we did all those decades earlier. It's just a different way of accessing research, and you can do a degree now without even setting foot in the library, and that to many people is a bit of an abomination.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'm quite old-fashioned in this, but as you get back to these sort of serendipitous things, you know, you're in the library, you're looking for one book, and there's sort of like a few books down on, you know, on the shelf, you see something else, you see something, aha, that's actually what I was looking for. I didn't quite know what I was looking for, which these days, you know, if you're searching all your books online or just accessing them online, you know, at least I find you never quite get that same experience. I mean, yes, sometimes you'll see something, maybe there's so much more stuff there, but it's also somehow just seems to me qualitatively sort of different, that the physical experience, which again, I mean, another, you know, thing I've been working on perhaps recently in my work is like this sense of embodiment as well, that our physical selves are important to us. And actually this reminds me of like all the way back to like, you know, sort of early undergraduate days, sort of philosophy of religion, mind-body problem. What if we were like just disembodied sort of minds in a jar and we, you know, contemplated these things? And, you know, I'm now bewildered, why on earth could anybody even think that was a sensible thing to talk about in various ways? You know, that our physicality, our location in time and space and sort of genderness and sexuality and everything else is so integral to our identities and our experiences, and like, you know, in the books, the touch and feel of, you know, you smell it, and it's different from just, you know, having it there on a screen. So there's this whole sort of like somatic aspect, which I think is it's hard to say there's a somatic aspect sort of missing in degree when, you know, degree is all about sort of, you know, ideas and thinking through stuff. But, you know, I think that has to come in and be part of this.
Yeah, and I think you touched on something really important there, because not too long ago I allowed one of my modules, actually it's a course called Death and the Afterlife, and it's obvious where the origins for that come from Lampeter, and it was sort of audited just to sort of see about the authorship of the books on the reading list, how many of them were Western, how many of them European, how many were from the Global South, how many were male, how many female, and so on. So it was a fascinating project in relation to BAME sort of studies, and I put this forward, and it came back that like over 90%, maybe even closer to 100% of the authors were white, male, and either European or North American, and that was interesting because 25 years ago when I was doing all of this stuff at Lampeter, you just took it as a given. This was the body of literature. This was the stuff we engaged with. It never occurred to me that all the authors were white, male, and European. And so it's a bit of, so even for me as the person who teaches on the module, I'm now having to sort of like rethink and almost retrain myself away from thinking that I have to, you know, if it doesn't have Paul Badham or John Hick on it, then it can't be authentic or real. And that's really interesting. So, and because I was brought up in that mindset, for me, it's a combination of horror that I've been sort of teaching stuff that's very sort of narrow over the years, but also that sense that there is, you know, that I have a lot to learn as well. And it's like the teachers at school, because I know you did your O-levels. I was the second year of GCSEs, but the teachers who had to be retrained, and some of them hated it and left the profession because they couldn't stand the thought of having to suddenly, you know, have a completely different way of teaching and their pupils being examined in secondary education. But I kind of feel that I'm in that place now, but it sounds like you've already, and not least, of course, because you're in Singapore, but you, in that sense, you're engaging through with a very different academic tradition.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the whole, if you like, sort of post-colonial decolonization thing. I kind of like at the fringes of my PhD, because of course, if you're looking at sort of Western sort of Christian views of sort of India, I mean, it kind of sort of came up. But I mean, I finished in 1999. That, I believe, is the year in which your ex-colleague, Richard King, sort of Religion and Orientalism came out, which, of course, you know, was the landmark book, which suddenly said, like, religious studies, this is where you take this seriously. So, you know, I was not really sort of pushed to go down there. But, yeah, my subsequent sort of work, of course, I read that book early on, and it's become part of where I do my academic work. I mean, it's been a learning curve. But again, you know, even before I came here, back when I was in Winchester, I brought in a new course on sort of global Christianities. You know, so it wouldn't just simply run our sort of, you know, very traditional sort of modern theology course, which, or contemporary Christianities, I think it was called, course, which I inherited, you know, kind of like, you know, Kant, Schleiermacher, Barthes, onwards to sort of white men, obviously women in there, as well as sort of engage something much more global. Yeah, and it's an absolute central part of all of the work I do now to some extent, you know, yeah, to look at this question of inclusion. I said, yeah, I've been in Singapore. I mean, it's a big issue here because all of my courses currently sit within Asian studies. So when I'm teaching something, okay, is this actually an Asian studies course? becomes a question. Actually, I sometimes, you know, discuss this quite frankly with students. You know, we do an Asian studies, all the theorists we've looked at, none of them come from Asia. Why is that? What actually is theory?
Yeah.
And, you know, we do certainly take as many Asian sort of theorists in as we can and look at sort of Asian case studies. But yeah, I mean, academia is going to be an ongoing project for a long time. And as you kind of sort of hinted, there are some academics who are on board with this, others who are not really happy with this, some of them who pay lip service to it because they feel that's what they've got to do or to be, you know, right on trendy and just sort of the sphere of the good. But perhaps don't take it so seriously. You know, I see lots of people talk about this stuff, but if you read their books, I won't mention any names here, but like, how come everybody you cite is sort of, you know, white and male, but you keep going around how important sort of decolonization is? You know, where's that from?
Yeah, no, the it's interesting, and also to be riding the crest of a wave in that regard must feel quite empowering, because if you were to go back to Lamperton now, you'd probably in that sense have a very different sort of understanding of the things that were the bread and butter all those years ago in terms of what you would be teaching now. And I think you're right, it also is important to reflect on the degree to which other people are able to move as those paradigm shifts are taking place, and how many people are still beholden to old paradigms. And to an extent, I would include myself in that, because it's a learning curve. But, you know, as I say, I still teach things sometimes, as I say, which are very much, I'm indebted to my Lampeter education. But sometimes, you know, even I have to accept that after 30 odd years, it's important, you know, not to sort of see that as the be all and end all. And also the students think with their feet as well. We have increasingly students from a variety of ethnic traditions and communities, much more so even than when I came to Kent in 2004. Let alone Lamperton, which was predominantly white. And I think that in that sense, you know, even if academics don't want to sort of move the goalpost too far, the reasons why students would come and study will come under scrutiny, because they will ask the question, you know, why would I want to do this now? And why would I want to do this here? How is it going to speak to me? And I think the privilege that maybe we had from education 30 odd years ago, you know, it doesn't necessarily follow that the reason that people went to university 30 odd years ago is the same now, when fewer people went to university in those days. So in many respects, there's a lot of cultural reawakening, I think, that needs to continue to proceed.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it was an incredibly privileged time. I mean, I was actually, not only did I get a grant, I was actually paid to go to university and all of my tuition fees were paid, but I believe I was the last year where actually my grant went up every year with inflation. So I got paid more each year while I was an undergraduate. Yeah, I mean, if I'd gone to university now, I mean, have to pay your fees, come out with debt. And I couldn't have afforded it if I wanted to do a master's degree, let alone a PhD. And, you know, I was lucky then you did get sort of bank loans. I even actually sort of doing my PhD. And again, I think I was one of the very last people who could do this. I actually signed on to do my PhD part-time. I also signed on as unemployed, and this was counted as my training. So I could basically collect my dole money to pay for my PhD. So, yeah, I mean, we were very privileged back then. I don't know if collecting your dorm money to do your PhD counts as being privileged or the opposite of privileged, but, you know, it was an incredibly lucky time to get through that route.
Yes, it was. And you're right. And I remember also when I was used to, like you, I was, you know, claiming housing benefit and so on. And I had to go every week or 2 weeks, whatever it was, to the building in Lambeth, where also the driving tests took place. And I was always fearful of meeting my driving test instructor, because I kind of knew that he'd be thinking, oh, these students who are, you know, were working hard and there they are claiming all these benefits. And so, you know, I'd often try to sort of like sneak into that building because I just didn't want to have that conversation, because I was aware of those kind of, maybe it was all in my head, to be honest with you, but it was just that perception that somehow, you know, students and claiming benefits, it seemed like, you know, whereas other people who hadn't had a university education, but, you know, might have, you know, had to work from the age of 16. So there were all those sort of conflicts, I think, which certainly I felt back in the 90s. But just as we start to wrap up, Paul, I did say that I would just ask you a bit more about some of those other sort of non-academic influences. You mentioned the one cinema in Maidenhead, whether it's music or film. Is there anything else from your formative years that's kind of stayed with you? Because I know, was it the I can never say it, the bonsai dog boot. You can say it better than me, but you often talk
about... No, actually, that's something I learned in Lampeter, rather than before. I mean, I have to say, as growing up sort of quite sort of young, I was never particularly into sort of pop music of my youth. I mean, I guess it was like being in the nerdy group. We didn't like do the sort of the pop stuff. And my father was very into classical music. So it was only ever classical music played at home. So, I mean, apart from when I was at sort of friends' houses and sort of hearing what they were playing, I didn't really, you know, have a great musical interest beyond bits of classical repertoire. I mean, having said that, I now feel like quite a big fan of all sorts of stuff that was on when I was young. So sort of ABBA and The Police and all of this, I love it now. But of course, also that was part of like True Lampeter, like, you know, the disco nights, all of this sort of stuff was also part of that repertoire there. So, yeah, I mean, everything from the Moody Blues to the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and the really early Pink Floyd, I mean, Pink Floyd, you know, Atom Earth Mother kind of stuff, long before they sort of sold out and came commercial to the Dark Side of the Moon and stuff. You know, really sort of weird bits of musical taste. It's stuff I learned at Lampeter. So, yes, that's all still with me in various ways. I mean, I don't know if it's an influence on me in terms of what I do, but yeah, I mean, it's there, I guess, in the background.
Yeah, and do your children listen to the same kind of music? Do they listen and think, oh, what is this stuff from the 20th century?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they're not really into my music. I mean, I should say my son actually is... he's plays the piano. He's passed his grade 8 in piano. He's now going on to do his diploma. He's very much like a classical music buff. My daughter is sort of far more sort of pop music kind of sort of stuff. And she loves Disney songs. So Disney songs are like a big part of her repertoire. But also, of course, with the half Chinese stuff, she listens to a lot of like Chinese pop music as well. So that's also part of like the whole household influence. Now, so it's a much more sort of multicultural, sort of diverse mix of stuff that they get in. And of course, being in Singapore, you know, but I mean, globally, of course, you get K-pop coming in everywhere and J-pop. And so, yes, I mean, what they get exposed to here and these days is a very different sort of, you know, mix from what we would have ever known about, I guess, you know, back in the day when, of course, you know, was... the cassette tapes were sort of like the basic sort of stock in trade of most of your music back then.
Absolutely. And what about things like radio? Because I think I, as you remember when we were living in the same house, radio was a massive influence on me. But is radio listened to anymore in Singapore?
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, there's the local ones. Actually, I mean, maybe a terrible sort of omission, but when I'm not listening to some of your stuff in the car, it's often the BBC World Service. Simply because they do better news than, if you like, most other sort of places. So you get good news and fantastic documentaries on there as well. But yeah, I mean, sometimes listen to some of the local things, but I said, I don't know, maybe I've never been the, you know, the big sort of radio fan. So why should I, they're all like the local DJs here. You know, if you, in the morning, there's Maddie, Jason and Divian. They're no longer, no, Jason's not in it. But anyway, these are like the three breakfast time, you know, I know who they are and stuff, and I've probably heard bits of them, but it's never been my cup of tea. I said I wouldn't come out and just listen to random pop music for the fun of it. I mean, if it's chosen stuff, when I'm out running, you know, I've got my sort of my Spotify sort of list on, and I've got my, like, you know, running music with, you know, a bit of ABBA, Eye of the Tiger, the Bangles, all sorts of stuff. So my youth is on there. But, you know, I wouldn't just listen to random stuff.
Yeah, no, you're right. And indeed, strategically, because I used to record lots of stuff illegally or otherwise off the radio, but I've still got all those tapes and I digitized them. So it's almost like when I'm on those long journeys, I'm both obviously focusing on the journey ahead of me, but I'm also mentally re-engaging with a period of my life when, you know, this was very much foundational. And I'm so glad I did that. We were talking earlier about, you know, sometimes serendipitous moments in life, but I think having those also reminds me of my roots as well, and I think that's important, because otherwise it can just be a complete cacophony of anything. And my children listen to, you know, Disney as well, but they listen to stuff, and they're only, you know, they're very young, and they've got musical interests that, you know, don't remotely resonate with me, don't connect with me. And I guess it was probably the same when I was their age with my parents, who, you know, although I do listen to a lot of the same music as my parents, but when I was growing up, it was always like, oh, that's just too loud, and they don't wear suits anymore like they did in you know, when Top of the Pop started, is that kind of thing. So we all sort of like turn into our our ancestors. But as we start to wrap up, Paul, I was just sort of thinking, would you say, as you look back on your life and career, are your memories predominantly positive?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a sort of a facet of being human, that, you know, we don't like to dwell on those sort of negative sort of things. So, I mean, I'm sure they're there. So, yeah, sort of looking back to my school days, you know, I mean, I don't remember sort of having to get up early in the morning and not wanting to get out of bed. You know, those kind of memories are not there. You know, I remember, you know, the playground and friends and, you know, some of my sort of, you know, favourite sort of teachers back at school. And then, you know, Lampeter, like your background, it, you know, it's a bright sunny day, you're walking into Hills, or, you know, you're in the Union Bar with a pint of something, or up at the Railway Hotel, that's closed now, a long time ago. I used to love
it. Yeah, it became a video store, didn't it, at one point in the mid to late 90s?
Yeah, I think it did, yes. Yeah, that was always one of my favourites there. And, of course, the King's Head was always a magnificent sort of place. So, yeah, there's lots of sort of positive memories. And, again, yeah, sort of moving on from there, I went out sort of to China, basically, after Lampeter, so 3 years there. And actually, getting back to music, I said, well, I mean, maybe music is not as important to me as some people. Actually, there are songs that particularly resonate as parts of my life. So Lena Marlin, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Lena Marlin.
Then name rings a bell.
Yeah, it rings a bell. But basically, it was round about, must have been 1999, sort of 2000, her first album came out. And it was something I was hearing basically just before I went off to China. And then everywhere was playing it when I got to China. So, yeah, I'm sitting down here. I'm not going to try and sing it because I sing so awfully. But anyway, I've got the CD of that. And that's there, sort of reminds me of that. And again, other songs, particularly some sort of Lampeter stuff. I mean, YMCA, I'll never get out of my head from Disco Nights in... Of course, that's not quite a date for it. It was a much earlier song. But, you know, you've got these things that sort of, like, give you time signals. And when you sort of hear them, oh, it takes you back. And again, you know, it's the good memories that sort of... come back in from this.
Yeah, because the converse of that is whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I think you kind of answered that question, really, about the way that we filter. We have this innate need to filter out maybe the things that are not so positive.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think there is, but you airbrush it. I mean, I think you have kind of, like, you know, is it the Monty Python sketch of, like, you know, the Yorkshireman about, you know, you back home, when I was young, we had to lick the road every day. Do you know, I mean... It becomes, in a sense, sort of like a positive memory. Your life is so much better now. And I mean, I think, you know, there's stuff about Lampeter we all moaned about. I can see Lloyd Tom behind you. I didn't have to live in Lloyd Tom, fortunately. But, you know, it's kind of like there's a certain nostalgia even about sort of Lloyd Tom now when you think back about it. And again, like the lack of facilities in Lampeter and the fact, you know, there was a certain kind of like day after day tedium. But, you know, that just becomes, oh, it was just, you know, quiet, idyll sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we find ways to airbrush I think, you know, those negative things and make them into sort of a positive thing. Or, you know, I went through that, you know, my resolve, I'm so much tougher for going through those tough times. So, yeah, I mean, I think the negative stuff is there, but it becomes these rose-tinted sort of glasses become, you know, the lens for it. I mean, of course, not everybody, I mean, you know, some people, I guess, you know, keep these much sort of darker sort of memories there because everybody's psychology is different. I mean, I'm fortunate, I guess, in that, you know, I've tended to remember the better things, or at least I'm sure the dark stuff is still there somewhere and waiting to sort of leap out at me at some unexpected moment. But yeah, I mean, you know, generally I look back and it's the good stuff that I remember.
No, but I think you're right, because often it can be those periods of struggle, whether it's, you know, waiting for that degree result or that, you know, the essay that's causing you the grief or relationship problems, whatever it might be. Sometimes that sends you on a soul searching kind of odyssey. And actually that can be useful because you go through it and hopefully you learn something from it. And then next time round, you sort of say, OK, I think I've got the resources to deal with this. So sometimes, you know, that's why I was drawn a lot, as you remember, in my PhD to film noir, because I thought, you know, a lot of the films I watch are terribly escapist, but I needed the counterpoint. And I think that was interesting, that it was as though sometimes, you know, it's lovely to watch sort of a very upbeat film, but sometimes you just need something to make you think why is life the way it is, rather than sort of, you know, have it sort of spoon-fed. And I think ultimately, as with so many things in life, you just need, like, I don't listen to the same, I'm not somebody who will listen to a CD or a cassette from the same artist. I like to mix and match, and I think that's interesting, that it's always that need to have different sets of experiences, and it sort of takes you, I think, on a much broader emotional range.
Yes, absolutely. But I see it's like those negative things, I said, say you like the positive, you know, it was your learning experience along the way. Yeah. So it becomes, if you like, a negative thing in, it becomes a positive thing in retrospect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I don't, you know, really look back on it. I mean, there are some things, you know, I should have done this and not that. But I don't tend to find myself dwelling on those. And, you know, again, as I realised, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now if I had have sort of taken that slightly different path. So maybe that would have been a much better sort of route for me at the time. But in it, I mean, it's also, I think, sort of partly an age thing. You know, I'm now slightly over the half way marked in a century, and you know, things just take on a very different perspective. That, you know, maybe even things that, you know, 20 years ago would have bothered me, oh no, you know, a terrible disaster in my life, and it's just, you know, you mellow a bit more perhaps.
Yeah, because actually that leads on well to the next question, which is whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, and indeed related to that, what would your younger self think about what you're doing now?
The answer is that, did I fulfill my dreams? No, because I didn't become a vet. But that was very young me. but that basically fell out during secondary school when I decided I enjoyed sort of like history, religious studies, English much more than I enjoyed the sciences. So it was like a rational choice there. I mean, I don't think for much of my teenage years I really sort of had ambitions. I mean, partly because my parents haven't been at university, so it was a thing, you know, it wasn't, they were expecting me to go over there and like get a high powered job or anything. So I was there and I quite enjoyed it and I was quite good at it, so I simply stayed on. And then it kind of, you know, do I want to leave and get a real job? No, I think I'll come on and stay and study. And so it was kind of like just like my default all the way through. And it didn't really kind of occur to me until later on in my PhD that maybe I should be thinking about some kind of sort of research sort of career out of this. You know, I was just doing the things that sort of made sense to me at the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think my younger self would be quite amazed at where I am now. And you mentioned sort of earlier, like, you know, when you're 18, you know, there's still a lot of sort of stuff, maturity. I think, you know, even when I finished my PhD, you know, I'm not the academic I am now. You know, when I go back and look at some of my early articles, you know, I just, you know, it's kind of like cringeworthily bad, some of this stuff. How could I possibly wrote that? And, you know, which, I mean, it's a good thing that, you know, I think I'm writing my best stuff now. And actually, in sync, I was talking to a much more senior sort of colleague, he's in his sort of 70s or maybe even sort of 80s, sort of now, very senior sort of philosopher. And he was sort of saying to me, oh, you know, it's the last 2 years I've actually written my best stuff. You know, basically, you know, it's the experience, sort of the wisdom, if you like, this combined stuff that, you know, which is very encouraging to me now. Because you kind of think, you know, 50, have I just hit the hill? It's all behind me now. I've done the good stuff. You know, I'm kind of sort of hopeful that there's still more to come.
Yeah, no, I share that as well. I feel far more productive in so many ways now. You know, it's a combination of the midlife crisis, but also that sense sometimes that, you know, if there are things you've always wanted to do and you haven't yet done them, do you just shrug your shoulders and say, well, you know, I've gone the last 50 years without doing them, so, you know, forget about it? Or do you say, well, hang on a minute, who's to say that they shouldn't be done and still can't be done? And that's why I find it always interesting. I mean, we've got a 78-year-old president of the United States, but there comes a point when you think, how interesting, because that actually, I think, is a really a good role model in many ways, because it just shows, you know, you shouldn't give up on something just because you have this perception that maybe there are always going to be younger people, whippersnappers, you know, who can do the job better. Sometimes I think, you know, now if there's something I really want to do, if I don't do it now, then I will regret it.
But, I mean, I guess one thing I wanted to do when I was younger and just never had the money was to sort of travel more, and I've done that now. I mean, that's one thing about being a sort of an academic, you know, you get paid to go to conferences in different places. And of course, I mean, something we didn't mention, sort of after my PhD, when I couldn't get a job straight away, I went off to teach English out in China. So kind of like, you know, I sort of made my chance to get some travel there. And now, of course, being in Southeast Asia, I mean, I've had a chance to sort of go around this sort of whole area here. So to a certain extent, you know, I mean, my life in perhaps unexpected ways has allowed me to sort of get off and sort of see all sorts of different places and diversity. But, you know, again, perhaps now as I'm sort of slightly older now, I don't have that sort of sense, oh, my God, I've really got to go here. You know, it's like, okay, I go there, you know, I don't go there. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. I mean, I've never been to Japan yet. I really want to go to Japan. I should have been there last year. Actually, I should have been in Rome last. Lots of things you've... But that's just the way of stuff, yeah. I haven't been to yet. But, you know, it's... I'm just not, you know... Okay, maybe I'll never get to see Rome in my life, but I'm not going to die because of that. I won't get to go to Kyoto. But, you know, I'm not going to die because of that. I, you know, life has been good on the whole. So, yes, that's generally where I am at the moment. Obviously, I don't know where I'll be in 20 years' time in my bucket list and thinking, oh, my God, I've got to get through this. But, yeah, I mean, at least at the moment, I mean, I'm pleased with where things have gone and the trajectory they've taken.
Well, it sounds like you've also already answered my last question, which is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Being in the present.
That's a very, you know, what a perfect answer. Yeah. And so many people I've asked that question too, and they've said, neither. Don't ask me those ridiculous binaries. Well, Paul, yeah. You know, it has been so wonderful to catch up with you. It's great to meet, because actually when I started doing these interviews, of course I was meeting people face to face, and I always thought, well, next time Paul's over in the UK, we must catch up and do an interview. But actually one positive benefit of lockdown, there aren't that many, is that it's actually a chance for us to catch up this way rather than wait for lockdown restrictions to end. So it's been fabulous to catch up with you again.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, as you say, this has been, you know, the only way of sort of communication. So it is an excellent sort of thing at this particular juncture of the world as things are working out.